Good morning. Welcome to hour number two, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and the deal, and Henry Franz at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we're pleased to have on the program some more folks who are here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in Roger Ebert's Film Festival. One of the films to be shown tonight is a documentary. It'll be shown tonight at 7 o'clock. The name of the film is The Real Dirt on Farmer John. And here in the studio with us, we have Taggart Siegel, who's the director, the filmmaker, and John Peterson, who is the man who is at the heart of this movie. It is in large part the story of his life and his experiences in farming. He's been working on his family farm since he was 7. Certainly in the years since then, he's seen a lot of ups and downs in the farm economy, including the financial crisis that almost closed the farm down for good in the 80s. But he is not only surviving today, he is running one of the largest community-supported agriculture farms in the United States. And how that came to be is one of the stories that the film tells. If you're fortunate enough to be able to see it at the festival, that's great. And if not, well, you can go down to wherever it is that you rent your DVDs, because it is available to see on DVD. And it's a very interesting movie. And I think it raises some really good issues about agriculture and where it's going today. So you can certainly see the movie if you don't get a chance to see it at the festival. I do also want to mention that John is the author of a book that's titled Farmer John's Cookbook, The Real Dirt on Vegetables, which is a book. It is what it says it is. It's a cookbook, and it's got a lot of great recipes in it. But I think also looking at it, you'll get some sense of what his philosophy of farming is. The book is published by Gibbs Smith. It's a nice big paperback. So if you're looking for good vegetable recipes, go out to the bookstore and look for the book. And questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much for
being here.
Nice
to be here.
We
thank
really
you
appreciate it.
Back in the Midwest. Feels like home.
So now your farm is in northern Illinois. Where exactly is your farm? Where did you grow up?
It's a bit east and south of Rockford, and it's about 70 miles west of Chicago, west and north of Chicago.
And this was a farm that had been in your family since your grandparents, your grandfather bought the farm?
Since the 30s.
Since the 30s.
Yeah, yeah, and I've been traveling a lot with this film now for a long time, over 3 years. And so I just landed in the Midwest about 3 days ago after being gone for a year. And it's a glorious feeling. I love being in the Midwest, even though it has its quirks, I guess, maybe just like I do. But it feels so good to be here and to breathe this air, and it's moist and sweet air in the spring. It's beautiful.
Yeah. It has, I think it has a particular aesthetic now. It's subtle, I think, the aesthetic mm-hmm. of the Midwest. And you know, having lived in Champaign-Urbana for a long time, I've talked to people who have come from other places where they have things like oceans and lakes and mountains. And they seem to think that the Midwest is rather flat and characterless. And I think I would disagree with that. But I think you got to look more carefully, because the features don't stand up and smack you in the face like mountains do. But that doesn't mean that the Midwest doesn't have character.
Well, this is why we created the Midwest Coast in the late 70s, because we felt people on the coast, the West Coast and the East Coast, we thought they maybe felt they had a little more going for them because they had coasts.
Yeah.
So we created the coast. We created the idea of a coast so that we could indicate to people that we had something going here too.
Yeah.
We actually built a beach and put shells on it and built a boardwalk, so we'd be a little more convincing. It's right along the edge of a cornfield.
You've got to see the movie to get really what it is we're talking about here.
Well, it was art and agriculture at that time, too. I mean, it was a pretty thriving farm at that time and an artist colony. Remind me a little of Andy Warhol's factory in the early 80s.
And this was what some of your neighbors weren't really quite sure about all this, you and the kind of folks that were hanging out there on your farm at this time that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, things escalated from there. But that was sort of laying the groundwork for future hysteria in the community. And but at that time, there was, since the community was more intact, the rural community there, I think it was kind of, there's even maybe a slight element of intrigue and affection that went along with all the suspicion and the confusion about our farm. But later, when the land started to be lost, when farms were going down, there was no element of sweetness in it anymore. That was when we became the Mecca, the farm that was a Mecca for devil worship and, oh my God, drug running and all kinds of diabolical things because the community needed a shadow. Yeah. But we certainly, I mean, I certainly had done my part for, how do I say, marginalizing myself by just being a little bit different in a rural community.
Yeah. So I want to ask Taggart, how long have you known John?
I've known John for 27 years, and I was going to Beloit College at the time, so 8 miles from the farm. And he came to an art opening and came up to me and put his arms around me, and he said, "What's your name?" And he wanted to get to know me. And then he invited me to his farm, and I went out to his farm, and it was like Shangri-La for me. I mean, there were artists living out there and farm. And I had never been on a farm before. So this was like, wow, there's chickens, there's pigs, there's cattle in the field, there's wheat and oats. And so it was a beautiful time to make my first film ever. And John starred in it. That was back in 1979.
Yeah. He never mentions all the beautiful women that were living out there at the time, too, that added to its appeal, I think.
Well, we see a few examples in the movie, yeah.
Yeah, that helped. Well, as an 18-year-old student.
And one of the things I think that really makes the movie is not only do you have a lot of wonderful home movies that John's mom, I think, mostly, or maybe some other people did it, but a lot of movies so that we see you and your parents and your family when you were a kid. But there's this other pieces of film that then Taggart Siegel shot. You shot over a long period of time, so you actually have a record. You've documented what John was doing various times in his life that you use then to tell the story.
Well, there's probably 27 years of footage that I shot, and his mother shot 25 years of that previously. And John shot some, too, during the hippie period. And so we're able to weave together 50 years of this man's life. I mean, almost every other year, every year we had some element on film capturing what this man was going through. So my 27 years my second film was a documentary, and that was his farm going down, and that was called Bitter Harvest. Mm-hmm. So seeing my best friends go down was a really tragic situation, and seeing him lose everything, and this film is the black and white film that you see in The Real Dirt on Farmer John. So we were able to see the whole transitional period of American farms just cascading, just collapsing during the 80s. John's was one of the earlier ones, but it was a very, very sad thing to see. So that film captured that time period. And then oddly enough, we kept making more films and fiction films. And he played... One film was the aftermath of losing the family farm that he wrote and starred in a film called Amber Days. And he plays a farmer that goes crazy and he buries the loan shark. So we were able to put that in. And all his travels down in Mexico and Guatemala, we're able to put into this film called The Real Dirt on Farmer John. So we have just... amazing amount of footage. Yeah.
I want to add in here, just so we don't overlook it during this show, that after my farm went down, and the film has a clip from this this play that I traveled with, that I wrote and toured with. I mean, I put it on, I performed it for maybe 25 or 30 communities in rural Illinois. That was in the mid-'80s. And I crisscrossed Illinois and with this performance, and I wouldn't be surprised if there'd be some listeners today who even attended one of those performances. And And now I'm back. I'm back in central Illinois, and it's just amazing to see, like, over, that's what, 20, a little bit more than 20 years ago that I was touring with the play, and to come back and have that feeling that of something even more lost than before, because the agriculture that is has sort of come into being out of that crisis and out of the worldwide changes in practices and the farm economy, it's really, I mean, it's a bit shocking. It's a bit disconcerting, and there were some very strong elements of the rural, of that very deep kind of community, rural community, and the connection to the land that came about before the chemicals, before the saturation with the chemicals and the tremendous technology, that I felt very strongly in the 80s. And to just drive down now and to just see the massive, massive fields and the massive equipment, and to be aware of the, what's happened in farming in general throughout the world, I mean, it's really something to absorb.
Yeah. Well, let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller here I want to bring in to the conversation. John Peterson, he runs Angelic Organics. It's one of the largest community-supported agriculture farms in the United States. He is also the subject of the documentary film The Real Dirt on Farmer John by our guest Taggart Siegel. They're both here in connection with the Roger Ebert Film Festival, the festival showing the documentary tonight. It has been seen in theaters and also on public television stations, and it's also now available on a DVD. So if you'd like to see it, you can. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here in Lovington. Let's bring them in. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I saw the documentary on PBS earlier, and I'm younger than you. I kind of had my own little summer of love. I went to U of I up there, and first summer I was home, several people moved down and lived with me, and so I probably related to it a little more because of that. But I also related to, I think I kind of felt some of the, angst, pressure, whatever I kind of saw in your film, that it was kind of an obligation to carry on because of, whatever. Because of your name on the farm and all that stuff, and that I was just commenting on that, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thanks.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes how much my passion to resurrect that farm came out of my need to redeem myself, because it had certainly gone down under my management. But also I know that I feel a very, very, very deep connection to the land. I don't have a farm to redeem now. I could call it redeemed. But when I've been out with the film now, traveling all over the world for the last 3 years or so, I noticed that pull. I noticed that yearning forming very deeply again. Like, I want to be back on my farm. I want to work. I want to be on that land. So besides the need to make right for what had gone wrong under my management, there's something else there, which is the siren of the land.
A lot of people lost their farms in the 80s, during the farm crisis of the 80s. The experience that you went through happened a little bit before that, and I don't know to what extent it was essentially the same problem. It was the beginning of the same problem. People were very highly leveraged, and it got to the point where they couldn't service their debts anymore. And also maybe we got to this point where unless you had a really, really big operation, you literally hundreds and hundreds of acres, that you couldn't make it. Do you feel that what happened to you and the fact that you ended up having to sell a lot of your family land was your fault, was bad management, or do you think it was stuff that was beyond your control?
I mean, it was a big sweep of a worldwide economic collapse in commodity prices. That is really what powered my collapse. And I was a little early on in that wave, and I would say that was because of some of my other interests and trying to finance them. And it's interesting. I mean, in a way, my approach, which was farming in a conventional way and using the regular methods, maybe doing a little bit differently. But then I had these other things about celebrating agriculture and making sure that it not be all work and all just immersion in the commercial aspect of agriculture. Just trying to look at it like, what is this? What is this that we do? It's not just a commercial act, even though a lot of people today want to say that. But I think that these other interests made me more financially vulnerable because they took some attention from the farm and they took some money. And so I was fortunate that my farm went down a little earlier and I could get out and still have something left. If it had been a year later, there wouldn't have even been a farmstead left for me to start up with. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So sometimes it's a good idea to have parties that cost you a little too much money.
Yeah. What, take it, aside from the fact that John is an interesting guy, and the story of his life is pretty interesting. So part of what the movie is about is it's just about him. It's his life story, but it's about a lot of other things too. What can you talk a little bit about? What about this story, or what kind of stories that are attached to his personal story interest you? You know, what is it that you're wanting people to think about or get, particularly people who have no connections at all to farming and who don't live in rural areas and to which this is like a foreign country?
Well, I really see it as a triumphant story of about a man who's a maverick farmer who went down and sort of figured out how to carry on in life. So it's all about survival. It's a lot of people can identify with this story. It's not just about farming. It's about a man that, when you lose everything, how do you survive? And then how do you kind of create a new life out of nothing? And that's exactly what my friend did, Farmer John. And he went on this journey. I see it as kind of an odyssey. John goes on this 8 years of reflection and a journey down to Mexico and Guatemala, and he returns back to his farm and he wants to get it going again, and this time very differently than he did before. And this time it's organic farming. And so it's a new form of farming that he started doing. And so we see this film that's like the rise and then the fall and then the resurrection of his family farm. Mm-hmm. And that is such almost a rocky story to me. It's like somebody that just battles on and somehow creates a thriving community-supported agricultural farm in America that actually is very effective and works very well concerning local food, where your food comes from, getting to know your farmer. That was a very important mission is sort of breaking down the preconceived notions of what a farm and a farmer is, and telling a tale of tenacity to inspire people so they could really get behind this kind of this story that has so many parts of his life, and also for people to examine. This was a really important part for me and John, was people to examine their preconceived notions, well, actually their judgments, and how they perceive people. So before John was ostracized in his community, and why was that? So that's what the film was really looking at too, is like before you judge somebody, kind of make sure you know where that's coming from. So mm-hmm. there's so many elements in the film that we addressed.
These universal themes of eating, mother, father, despair, living on the planet, I mean, these are things that this is why I think the film plays so well in so many countries, and why it plays just as well in cities as in rural areas, because it's not, I think that it's not primarily a farm film. It's a film about journeying through life and how we encounter our obstacles and how we move forward.
Mm. I'm just, one of the things I'm curious about, because John narrates the movie, and there are a lot of places in the movie where he's essentially directly addressing the camera and directly addressing the audience and sort of telling the story, talking about what has happened to him and what's happening to him at that point. How much does did he, and I'm looking at the guy who's officially the filmmaker, I mean, how much did he and his input really end up shaping what the final product was?
Well, very much so. I mean, I came on in 1996 to start filming John's life again after years of filming him previously, and to realize that he was in the middle of almost a little crisis going on, like how to survive as an organic farmer. And that's when he was evolving into being a community-supported agricultural farmer. Mm-hmm. So he was really just swamped with work and farming, and it took John a couple years before he got more and more involved in the process, the creative process of helping structure the film. First of all, he wrote many stories about his life, so I had a wealth of information anyway that I could refer to his essays on farming. And then when you start, we realized I didn't want to narrate it as a director. I didn't want to get an impersonal narrator. And it really made sense that Farmer John was the voice, that mm-hmm. he actually wrote his story that could work with the film. So there was always that to and froing, like, okay, John, we need to move the story forward. What element in your life can you write some narration? And anytime I tried to write some of the narration for him, he didn't like that at all. So I realized that, wow, I have to really, really respect what John, that his voice needs to be in this film in a big way.
Well, I want to say that I kept saying, Taggart, don't make me into a hero. I don't want that job. So when I always felt he wanted to glorify me a little too much, and yeah. I was like, tone it down, come on, I want more problems, because I don't want to go out in the world having to be someone who's like modeling a certain type of ideal behavior, because it's too much pressure. That was one thing. Another thing is that my autobiography, which has been derailed by this work with the film, which is going to be, I'll be completing next year, but to have a film out in the world about my life, it has to sync up with the book I'm writing about my life. Yeah. So there needed to be a real kind of adherence to the actual details of my life and a resonance with the writing that will be coming out about my life. Yeah. That was an important thing.
So you've had this experience that not many people are going to have, that you can sit down and look at a movie, and this is the movie of your life. And I can't quite imagine what that must be like to sit there and watch it. Do you watch it and you think, yes, that's me, or is there some sort of gulf there between you and that guy who's up there on the screen? And what?
It's a great question. It's a minute and a half on the screen for every year of my life. Minute and a half. So I said, you okay? Tell me about the last year of your life. You have a minute and a half. There'd be some pieces missing. And so I look at the movie often kind of aching to get my autobiography done so I can elaborate on some of the parts that are there and then parts that are missing. But the thing is about the film, you know, watching it, and certain things will jump out at me at different screenings. I don't usually sit through the whole thing. I mean, I've presented probably 300 screenings of the film. But I see parts of it at almost every screening, and certain things jump out at me. Like, Well, I'm very fascinated with my equipment, which I'm not around the last few years, and so I have to think about what it needs or what might be should be greased or what should, the oil should be changed. So it's sort of a reminder that I have equipment and it's got to be taken care of. Mm. And then certain elements will come up, like certain memories will come up about neighbors. Like they're just lie buried. And then maybe like after the 200th screening, I'll remember some experience I had with a person in that film that had been completely blacked off for me. So it's a very interesting journey. But as far as the idea of like, you know, some people like, I never had a fantasy about seeing myself on the big screen. Some people want to be in the movies. And I don't really have that thing going on. Like, oh, look, I'm bigger than life. I'm on the big screen. But the thing was, because I said to Taggart, look, this is a pain. Making this film is a pain. Yeah. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of struggle. And I said it's not worth it unless it's a story worth telling, unless it's a story that moves people. That's the whole point of it. Otherwise, why? To have my image on the screen? No. No, I tell you, I running a tractor all day long without a camera guy there, it's a joy. Running a tractor all day long with a camera guy there, it can be really irritating. You know, the cloud goes over, it comes under the sun or the whatever. You know, you're putting the grain in the hopper, and then the guy's like, well, can you put it in? I need to be over here. Wait, my battery isn't working. Wait, I got to. You know, who wants that when you're farming? Well, if it's going to be a story worth telling that the world's going to benefit from, yeah.
And it's an interesting process because in film, I was making a number of other documentaries at the same time, so I didn't know filming my, you know, good friend what it would actually turn into. I knew there was a triumphant story there, a recovery, but I was a little bit too close to the material. It was like very hard for me to get objective, so I had to have some really tough editors that would really, okay, let's get away from your personal footage that you might have. I mean, we have 250 hours of footage. Yeah. Now, just, you know, it's 83-minute film. So imagine all that other footage. And some is just
a lot
like,
of it's relationship footage.
Yeah.
So, my girlfriend's.
Yeah, I mean, it could be great extra footage for another DVD. But it's just really hard as an editor and a director to decide really what goes into the final film. And somehow I feel like we've succeeded. We make people cry. We make people laugh. And there's this feeling of that people get emotionally moved by the film. And it's also, you know, it's won 31 film festivals around the world. And a lot of those are audience awards. Those are the awards I really love because that's just like those are the people that like it. Those are the people sitting in the seats getting to vote.
Yeah. We're just a little bit past the midpoint here. For anybody who's just tuned in, I want to introduce again our guests. Taggart Siegel, he's a director and documentary filmmaker. His film, The Real Dirt on Farmer John, one of the films that are being shown this year during the Roger Ebert Film Festival. It's also been seen in theaters and a lot of festivals. It's shown on PBS. There is a DVD available if you want to look at the movie, and I would certainly recommend it. It's all about this other guy who's here with us, John Peterson. He runs Angelic Organics. It's one of the largest community-supported agriculture farms in the U.S. A lot of people in the Chicago area enjoy the produce that comes out of his farm. He's also, by the way, the author of the book Farmer John's Cookbook, The Real Dirt on Vegetables, Seasonal Recipes and Stories from a Community-Supported Farm. So you might go out and look at that. And the questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. See, I can imagine that this would be a kind of project that would destroy a friendship and that they would come to a point where maybe, you know, John, you would say, if you don't get that camera out of here and away from me, I'm going to smash it and I don't ever want to talk to you again. Were there such moments?
Oh, yeah. What do you say, Taggart?
You know, you're pretty good when we're actually filming. It was more in the editing phase of just communicating the story. And John being on the farm and me being in the edit room and working with the editor all the time and then having John, you know, send him a cut and getting comments and, you know, agreeing or not agreeing. Well, I'm the director. This is my truth. And John had his sense of truth. And then how, what was amazing out of this film is that I really learned that you really need to communicate with people. You need to be very upfront about what your intentions are, what your missions are. And I learned to work with people with this film instead of just trying to be the director. And, you know, just being the director is no fun. But working with people and hearing their point of view, taking it in, not taking it in, to me is it made filmmaking a lot more enjoyable.
Hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask John Peterson about was, particularly at this point where after the farm had failed and you had to end up selling a lot of land, and at that point where you spent some time traveling in Latin America. That was something happened to you, apparently, or you saw something that made you feel that not only did you want to go back to farming, but that you wanted to do it organically. What was it that happened or that you saw, or was there anything in that you could point to in particular that said, yes, not only do I want to farm again, but I want to farm it in this way?
Well, it was a gradual development. If you look at the film, the story as a three-act story, which conveniently my life has fallen into. Three acts, and now what's this called? The epilogue? What comes at the end?
Yeah, epilogue, yeah.
That being out with the movie.
The thing so that comes how, afterwards?
That's how my autobiography is going to be structured. But it really happened three acts, and the first turning point was the auction. It's very crisp, and like, there it is, the auction. And the second turning point was sort of like this unfolding revelation. Well, revelation, I think, is more condensed. It's more like a realization that evolved, that surfaced, that it was about this yearning for the land. It's amazing for me. I'm like, that? Are you kidding? I started noticing. I'm going, no, wait a minute. That farm, it just about ruined your life. I mean, you really are feeling you want to be back? I tell you, and I'd be around in the Midwest in the spring and smell that air. It's before it got so permeated by Roundup, but to just be in that beautiful, sweet, soft air of the spring is intoxicating for me. But I'm going, wait, no, that's just a hardship. That's just going to be the path to more ruin. But it got stronger and stronger, that desire to be on the land. And then to think, well, how would I do this? And I felt that my relationship to the land had really been obscured with the chemicals that I used and a lot of the technology where I was removed from it. I wasn't connected to it. You know, there are a lot of mitigating kind of technological inputs that we can apply to agriculture that can distance us from the land. And I know farmers who work with those very intensively still have a connection, but it's different than the connection you have with an organic farm where you're really working with something. I'm going to stick my neck out here and say, you know, it feels more authentic because there's not some mask of intensity of health, of like a kind of health veneer that comes from all these chemicals. What are they used for? Well, they're actually used to supplement what isn't working in the natural system. So how about working with the natural system so that it is brimming with health and vitality? Also, I'd been around too many people on drugs. And for me, it seemed like they were masked and they were distant, and they weren't accessible, and they weren't authentic because of how they were often permeated with their drug states. And I associated that with farming. I wanted something that was authentic and revealed in agriculture.
The other thing that I'm really curious about and wanted to have you talk about was when you made that decision, that was the way that you're going to farm, that you wanted this to be an organic farm. What all you had to learn about farming that way You grew up on a farm, and it sounds like you grew corn and soybeans, and you did it with conventional, whatever was the conventional state-of-the-art means of the time.
Yeah.
So to go from that to then growing organic vegetables, it must have been you had to completely learn a totally different way of doing things.
Oh, yeah. It was a terrible learning curve. It just about crushed me. And I had... I was running around 800 acres of corn and beans, and then I had hogs and cattle when the farm went down. So I thought, well, 9 acres of vegetables, that's what I'll start with. It's my first garden. 9 acres.
9 acres. Now, that's a pretty big garden, really. You know.
And it was just a disaster for years. But eventually I got the hang of it. But so, it was the organic systems, and then it was the just the vegetables versus the grains. I see why farmers want to raise grain. My gosh, you put it in a bin and dry it, and it keeps, and you can sell it when it's, you know, you feel it's time to sell it. Vegetables are totally different. You're just scampering all the time because they're always in a state of, or many of them are in a state of rapid decay. Yeah. But I think I want to bring up this because when I drove down here from my farm for the Ebert Fest, and I was really affected by these huge, huge fields. I mean, when I was touring with the play, there were big fields, and now it seems they're bigger. It seems that the expansion has become more and more pervasive. And I think we have to remember this question. What is agriculture? What is it? What's that word, culture, in agriculture? Why has it been converted into agribusiness? What is it that we've lost? And is that something important to look at? Like something that's been lost out of this, you know, I understand the preoccupation with survival, with financial survival. You have to survive financially if you're going to stay in business. But when if it overwhelms the other elements, the other attributes, you know, the things about farming that make it really special and powerful and a contribution to society, a contribution to culture, it has to be looked at. And like on our farm where it's a community-supported agriculture farm that people join and they get their season's vegetables from it every week, and they have a relationship to this piece of land. And there's something humanizing about it. And there's something that the farm is a mecca. It's a cultural mecca. It brings people together around the land. And what I see in driving down to central Illinois is that the way most farming is done today in the Midwest, it's about replacing people. And I understand it from an economic standpoint. But what are we losing by not having people in relationship to the land? I mean, there are a lot of other things to look at in how farming is done. I mean, there's, look at the Mississippi, look at the Gulf of Mexico, look at all the toxins, look at the water that we drink when we pull a glass of water from the tap. Those are also important considerations. But just what has been lost culturally, what isn't there anymore? It's something to look at. It's something. I mean, In the film where Taggart interviews these old timers and you really feel the earth coursing through them and you feel their relationship with the land coursing through them, and there's something very noble about these old farmers. And, I just wonder, I mean, people will say, oh, but it's the future. You can't fight the future. But it's progress. But is it really progress? I don't know if that's really the right term for it. It's something that's happened, and then we justify it because it's happened. Yeah. Michael Pollan's book, An Omnivore's Dilemma, does a great job of addressing this.
One of the things I think it's interesting about the film, in addition to, you're taking the opportunity to tell the story of John's life, but really, as I was watching it, one of the things I was thinking about is that in part, what it is that you have documented is a way of life that's gone.
Yeah, the 80s, all the farms went down. And to even for my short time on this earth, actually it's not that short, but it's long enough to witness a decline of this small American family farm. Now, that was really a remarkable thing, to be going to Beloit College, and then John takes me out to his farm, and then he says, hey, let's go see this neighbor, and we'd go meet some of the neighbors, the ones that were really friendly with him. And it was a magnificent experience, because there was always these chickens and pigs and cows and friendly farmers. I mean, you could see that they were just rooted in the land for the last 100 years, their ancestors or even longer. And I just felt like, wow, this is so special. It'll never disappear. There's no way it could disappear. I mean, I wasn't thinking like that. In fact, I studied anthropology, and I'm interested in cultures that are disappearing or trying to capture the last moments before they really disappear. That was an interest of mine, but I didn't realize I was actually capturing part of the decline of the American family farmer.
Yes. And I want to say, all over the world, because I've shown this film all over the world, there are people who want to reconnect to the land. There's this yearning in the urban areas in which people, they feel for the land, but it's an abstraction because they don't have a place. They don't have the uncle's farm or the aunt's or the grandpa's farm. It's gone. So it becomes an abstraction. They want to do something for the planet, but unless people have this deep personal relationship to it and how it works, then it's an abstraction. But people want to join farms. They want to know farmers. This CSA movement, Community Supported Agriculture movement, really strikes a chord with so many people, because then when they belong to a farm like that, then the weather, the climate in that area, the weather of that season, the soil in their region, all of these things take on a different meaning. And I tell you, we'll never change anything if we exist in this realm of abstractions. Like, well, we should save the earth. Well, we should have cheap food. Oh, we should. You have to be in the process to experience, to know what it is. Know the farmer. Have a relationship to the land. See the struggles. And the farmer knows the consumer, the member of the farm. Build something out of that. Extraordinarily magical things happen. As soon as people say, you know, I'm going to join a farm, I'm going to become a member of a farm, that's when really deep cultural and ecological change starts to happen.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left, actually maybe more, about 7-8 minutes left. Our guest, John Peterson, Taggart Siegel. John Peterson is a farmer. He runs Angelic Organics. It's one of the biggest community-supported agriculture farms in the U.S., and he is also the subject of the documentary film The Real Dirt on Farmer John by Taggart Siegel, who's also here. They're here for Ebertfest. They're showing the movie, and it is available on DVD, so if you want to watch it, you can go out and you can look for it. We do have time for some other questions. In fact, we have somebody here who's calling in. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's someone in Oswego, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
How are you guys today?
Good.
Hey, I wanted to put a comment in and ask you, too. American society in general, there are so many different nationalities now in this country. Would you consider being kind of like a dying true American breed now? And the other thing is co-ops. I know where I'm at, and I'm sure out there where you guys are at, we got a lot of co-op farming. And it seems like a lot of people from the urban jungle comes out to kind of like have farm plots because they can't have them in the cities. And they've kind of talked to all these, like you were saying, talked to these other farmers out here. And kind of, in one hand, it seems like they're trying to save them. On the other hand, you know, the price of land is extremely expensive. And I see them being bought out by developers all the time just for the fact that they can't afford to farm them anymore.
Well, the Colonel Reese is a couple of really good issues. I don't know how you want to respond. Particularly this idea that, you know, for people who actually, maybe people who live in the city who would actually like to get their hands in the dirt, would actually like to grow some things for themselves, how is it possible for people to have that kind of experience? Or is it possible for people to have that kind of experience?
Urban agriculture is it's on the upswing. I mean, it's really an extraordinary phenomenon. Now, the Angelic Organics Learning Center teaches some programs in Chicago to help people get gardens going, get beehives going. It's fantastic. I mean, it's really a big, big development in, throughout the world. So that's very encouraging. But just to, I want to address this other question about being, you know, the American, or if I'm what kind of American I am. I mean, my people came from Scandinavia. So in a way, that's similar to how many people come today, except that they just came earlier and they're more embedded. But I just got something today, because we opened our film in New Zealand, and we've gotten this story, we've gotten these comments from other people too. But today it hit me once again. They said, "I'm really encouraged about the United States. This has softened my opinion, my disdain for what's going on in the United States, because we are not that warmly regarded throughout much of the world out of these policies that we've implemented and inflicted. But this story warms people up towards the United States, and they see it as the story of the untold story of America and of American agriculture. There's over 2,000 CSA farms in the United States. The United States is regarded as the home of genetic engineering and heavily industrialized agriculture. But when I've been out in the world saying, you know what, there's over 500,000 people in the United States who get their farm from, or their food from, a community farm. The U.S. is the country with the most community-supported agriculture farms in the world. And that's a message people out in the world, throughout the world, are really, really excited to hear.
Something that I got on the call here I want to try to get to, but something I really wanted to get to was there clearly is demand and interest in organic product. Yeah. A lot of people, though, for them, it's going to be a problem because they can't afford it. There's a premium for organic. Is it possible to do this and do it in a way so that price is not going to be so much an issue for people?
Well, you know, there's a premium on junk food, too. It's not what you pay for it. It's how your arteries get clogged and all the other health problems you get from eating it. So it's a hidden cost. I mean, I think a lot of it is education and getting people to kind of go, well, you know, maybe we'd just be better off if we bought this food that costs more off the shelf, but maybe we'd be healthier. So that's one thing to look at. And the other thing is, with community-supported agriculture farms, the there are often programs that subsidize low-income shares that are in place, and also the organic food is cheaper anyway, because the middleman is sort of – that role is – not exactly eliminated, but the benefits of that middleman not being there accrue to both the customer and to the farmer.
So it's a different kind of story if you can actually go direct to the producer, rather than if you're going down to the supermarket and buying something that says has organic written on it.
And I think people should always recognize that when they're paying, I mean, ideally, especially if they're going directly to the farmer, farmers need to be supported. We can't have desperate, nearly broke, anxious farmers presiding over our lands, our agricultural lands, and expect that we're going to get a shift in how the planet is being taken care of. Farmers have to be taken care of.
And one of the great things about the CSA model is that the foods come locally. They're really just right down the road. Is you're a farmer and you could get your food fresh like a couple days later. What I'm kind of concerned about is that food now is shipped, you know, from all over the world, from China and from Argentina and New Zealand. And do you really want your food from there when you could get it locally? I mean, when you could really get it fresh and organic. So I think supporting your local farmer, CSA farmer, is an incredible way to build culture and society. Okay.
I want to try real quick to get one caller here and one more caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. There's an element of the question raised by the previous caller that I find disquieting, that there somehow was an American ethics system, whatever, but that it was central and unitary. And it seems to me that from the very beginning, this was a community of many diverse groups from various parts of the world, including the Native American, and that the introduction of additional cultures is not inherently threatening, but is all actually quite promising. This is a syncretic culture. It has evolved. It continues to evolve. And we should remain open to all elements of the society.
All right. Well, I expect that that is something that you would agree with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a very nice way to, I guess we're about ready to close our program.
Yeah.
And I think it's great to point out what our roots really are and the promise of our future.
Well, we do have to finish, but for people who were in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you're lucky enough to have tickets, you may be able to see the movie that we have talked about, The Real Dirt on Farmer John. It's being shown as part of Roger Ebert's Film Festival. That's tonight. It has been shown in theaters around the country and on PBS. In fact, it's been shown all around the world. And if you would like to see the movie, well, go down to wherever it is you rent your DVDs. Go to the library and look for it because you can watch it that way. Our guests are Taggart Siegel. He's the director and the filmmaker of The Real Dirt on Farmer John. And John Peterson, who is Farmer John. He is also the author of the book, Farmer John's Cookbook, The Real Dirt on Vegetables. A lot of good vegetable recipes here published by Gibbs Smith. He runs Angelic Organics, one of the biggest community-supported agriculture farms in the United States. Thank you both very much.
Nice to be here.